week of June 21st, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 499.
Woo! One more show. One
yes,
more show.
Well,
then we'll be at episode 500 with a cast of thousands or nobody.
Well, we are the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, back from the French Riviera, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Splash Mountain at Disney World, I'm Michael Giltz. What? What were you doing at the French? Oh, virtually.
Virtually, yes. That's right. It is the Marché du Film. It is the Cannes Film Market without the Cannes Film Festival. And so, yeah, they're doing it virtually. They're doing it online and they're doing it right. They're doing a really great job.
What entails doing it right? What are the elements or features that are telling you, yes, they're doing what you want them to do? Or is there some things that are unexpected, like, oh, that was a good idea?
You can actually, they have an app where you can chat with other people that are attending some of the sessions or people that kind of match with you. You know, you kind of say what you're there for, if you're looking for distributors, if you're looking for journalists, if you're looking for filmmakers. You can meet people. Not everybody has that turned on. So there are some people there, like the head of Neon, who says, here I am, here's my bio, here's my photo. No, you can't chat with me. No, you can't request a meeting. But they're doing some lovely live sessions that are recorded video-wise. Some are on Zoom, mm-hmm. of course. And then, of course, they have screenings. Now, I haven't attended any of the screenings because I am not a film buyer, and I really don't want to infringe upon, you know, what sales agents are trying to do. So I kind of leave that up to them.
Well, as long as you're upfront about who you are and you like to do one just to see how it's working, I think if you told them that, that would be okay.
Yeah. And they even have, you know, a directory of the attendees. When you get there, you get a virtual goodie bag. And by goodie bag, I mean a welcome bag where you have all of the pamphlets that you would normally get on paper. They've given you virtually. And guess what? You know, the trades that get printed every single day, mm-hmm. they have a whole press rack where Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and Screen International, they're giving out daily publications. It's really fascinating. They're really pulling it off.
Well, I think you should do a screening just to see how it works and tell them you're doing that so that you pick a film that's probably not the most in-demand film and then you'll be okay. But that's cool. I hope other people considering digital conferences will look at them and steal the best ideas and try to improve some stuff where they want to and do their own great job.
Yeah. Is that a hint?
Yes, it is. But why don't you ask me about where I'm at?
Well, you said you were at Splash Mountain, which, you know, I'm looking on my map. Wait a second. Actually, it's in Anaheim. Wait a second. It's right in the middle of Disneyland.
And it's also at Disney World and Disneyland Tokyo. A couple things to clear up since I had some information wrong. I said, you know what? They don't have Splash Mountain at Disney World. And that was true when I was 12. But apparently, they've added it since in the last 30 years, they've added it. So there is a Splash Mountain at Disneyland, Disney World, and Disneyland Tokyo. The first one was at Disneyland in California, and that opened in 1989. That is about 3 years after Song of the South was reissued successfully in theater during the Reagan era, which is an argument as to why they released it at that point, because they had avoided it in the eras after it originally came out. It was the one film they didn't re-release, but Reagan became president. They said, you know what? We think the time is right. So they released Song of the South. It had a relatively successful theatrical release. And then they did a theme park ride based on Song of the South. I thought they just used the song Zippity-Doo-Dah, but in fact, the whole ride is built around the animated sections of the movie. Those sections are uncontroversial to most people. It's just Brer Rabbit, Brer Fox, old folk tales. You can argue whether white people should retell the stories of enslaved people, but putting that aside, the animation section of the movie is not racist and it's considered wonderful, at least for the people who've seen it. And that is very much the basis of the ride. So it's not a simple thing of like removing Zippity-Doo-Dah. The whole thing is based around the Brer Rabbit. So if you want to get any vestiges of Song of the South out from that ride, you have to completely refigure it and frankly get rid of the song Zippity-Doo-Dah, which Disney does not want to do because they love the song and it won an Oscar. So that is true. So I was wrong about that. And I was wrong about how strongly it's tied into the film. And also that brought up the fact that Pirates of the Caribbean, that has been changed and tweaked over the years, not just to incorporate Jack Sparrow in the movies. They've also changed stuff like there was an auction of women. I remember that when I was a kid, there was an auction. They were auctioning off a woman for bride to other pirates. Now that's been changed that the woman is also a pirate and they're auctioning off loot. That was one change. And another one, which I remember vividly, is there was a pirate who was chasing a woman into a house, and he'd be chasing a woman in the house. But then towards the end of the ride, when you saw that scene reenacted, she was chasing him out of the house with a frying pan, sort of a reversal of fortune. But now they have the women carrying food so that the pirate is chasing presumably the food rather than the woman. You know, the ride is for kids and families. I have no problem with any of that. You know, you don't want to show women being auctioned off? A sign of the time, sure, but is that too PC for me? No, not at all.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into, yeah, okay.
I just want to create we were factually wrong about Splash Mountain. I wanted to clarify that. The ones in Disney World opened up in 1991, I believe. That is very recent.
It is.
I thought it was in Disney World only, and I figured it was begun right after the movie or in the 50s or something. That's done long after they should have known better, because the movie alone was, had a lot of controversy around it when it opened. As you can learn from the podcast, you must remember this. Not a podcast I'm a huge fan of, but it had a storyline about Song of the South, and there were some interesting factoids in there. So I did listen to all those episodes, and it's always ongoing and tackling new stuff. So it's out there. You all are probably familiar with it, but that's another podcast. What's going to happen this week on our podcast?
Oh, you mean we're going to actually...
Yes, we are.
Okay. Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got not one guest for you, not two guests for you.
Oh, my God.
But we have no guests for you, actually. Okay. You see what I did there? Because, you thought maybe, Okay. Well, however, we've got our usual roundup of industry news and analysis. And for added fun, we'll be interviewing ourselves. And I mean that really. We will be interviewing ourselves, and you'll see why. First, we'll have a roundup of coronavirus updates and how it's affecting everything from theater in the West End to the Academy Awards. Not to worry, a new source of info on how to adapt is coming to the rescue. The adult film industry. That's right. We'll explain. On Inside Baseball, we'll celebrate the planned reopening of the major chains in North America come mid-July. And then we'll spoil the party by looking at the many, many, many challenges new exhibitors will be facing on day one. And it's not necessarily new exhibitors, but new challenges.
It's many, many.
Yes.
Many.
Okay. Well, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office we're looking at the video on demand in North America only. We have a chart covering the week of June 8th through June 14th, courtesy of ComScore. We have a link in our show notes. We are listing the most popular films on basic video on demand in North America, meaning specifically the United States and Canada. Obviously, North America actually incorporates more countries, but not for the purposes of box office. We've got 10 films. We rank them in order. That's the info we have. We don't know how much money they've grossed, but looking at where they rank, we can get a sense of how popular they are in relationship to one another. This is what it got. This is what we're going to go with. We have two new films on our list. First, at number one, is The Invisible Man, starring Elizabeth Moss. At number two is one of our new films. It's The Hunt. That's the broad satire horror flick, Red State versus Blue State, taken to extremes. At number three is Bad Boys for Life. At number four is Sonic the Hedgehog. At number five is Jumanji, The Next Level. Then we have five more films. At number six is Survive the Night. At number seven is our other new film. It's Think Like a Dog, which I think has ended up going straight to video on demand when it might have had a theatrical release. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but it's a boy and his dog story. In this case, the boy and the dog develop a psychic link. It happens. And it stars Josh Duhamel and Megan Fox. And number eight is Blumhouse's Fantasy Island. At number nine is The Call of the Wild. And number 10 is Bloodshot. The thing that stands out to me is The Hunt. This was a movie that had a lot of a press, a lot of attention. Invisible Man was out on premium video on demand. So I don't know if The Hunt was. I forget. Was The Hunt on premium video on demand as well?
I don't know. I wouldn't be shocked if it was, because it had just been released.
Right. So maybe the reason it didn't beat out The Invisible Man and hit number one was because it had already been more popular on premium video on demand. I don't know. I'm just surprised it wasn't able to debut at number one. Or maybe The Invisible Man is tearing it up. Maybe it's getting great word of mouth. We'd love to know. If you've got more box office info about video on demand, if you got some numbers, or you have anecdotal evidence that people are really talking up The Invisible Man, let us know.
Or independent films, or films in France or Germany or
UK. On video, if you get, they're doing video on demand. If you got a chart to share with us from anywhere around the world, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, you can reach us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And of course, we're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We are also on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is our page where you can like us.
Right. We can't wait for the box office to come back. How sad my life has been since USA Today, even before then in the, what was that, the 80s? I have looked at box office figures every weekend my entire life, pored over them like a sports geek staring at the box score for after a baseball game. I love that stuff. And we've got some more good news. Cineworld has reopened, or they're going to reopen, I should say. They've announced the reopening date for the US, UK, and Europe. That's going to happen in June and July. That must be good news for everyone, right, Sprone? That's the last big major?
Yes, and of course, we talked last week about Cineworld, which owns Regal here in the United States. They were in the process of buying Cineplex Entertainment in Canada, and of course, you know, they said, oh, well, we're not going to do it because there's a Cineplex, there's some fraudulent activity and we're not getting all the data and, you know, they breached their contract. You know, there's some debate about whether that's true or they just wanted to get out of the $50 million kill fee. Mm-hmm. But last week during Cine Europe, there was a moment there where Mookie Greidinger, who was the head of Cineworld, was asked about consolidation. He was asked among the other panelists. And just as they got to Mookie and he was saying, you know, well, the important thing and the most important thing to remember about consolidation is bloop, like literally there was some technical glitch.
Hilarious.
And when they came back, nobody was there. So it's like, I was wondering if the head of Cineplex was pulling the power cord.
That's hilarious. Oh, we just have breaking news. It's not in our obituary section. But
I know what you're
going to
say.
The director of Batman just died at 80. Good heavens. Well, he made some very commercial films. He was an interior decorator. He did windows at like Rota on Mary Tyler Moore. Didn't he do window displays originally? And that
I think so. Yeah. I mean, he was definitely a designer of some kind.
Yes, and he had the infamous Batman and Robin with Chris O'Donnell and George Clooney. He made a movie with George Clooney and made him look silly. That's not easy. But he had hits like Sanimals Fire, The Lost Boys, and Falling Down. So an interesting, fascinating career. Probably a guy who's more interesting than the films he made, I would say, if that's not too cruel or mean. But he's a character. He's an interesting guy. And he's now dead. I'm not sure what he died of, but he was 80. So he had a year-long battle with cancer. So that's very sad. Our sympathy, of course, goes to all his family and friends and the people who knew them. But there we go. Another filmmaker dead. I guess we're happy it wasn't COVID-19, right?
it's a sad world,
but you're like, oh, good. It wasn't that. It's like when I heard gay people dying, like, oh, it wasn't AIDS? Oh, good. For many years, you were just happy when it wasn't AIDS.
Well, we were talking about Joel Schumacher. I was talking over you when that was announced.
Yeah, probably one of his better films is Tigerland, and that helped turn Colin Farrell into a star. So that's probably one of his best movies. But yes, he was a costume designer. Lots of costume designing credits, including Woody Allen's Sleeper, Play It As It Lays, and stuff like that. Oh, and Woody Allen's interiors. But I think he also did window displays like Rhoda before that even happened. But maybe I'm wrong. So too bad about Joel Schumacher. So we're moving along. So that's good news about Cinemark. They're open, Cineworld. They are opening up. I did misspeak, however. I said that's the last one. I'm talking about the major chains in Europe in that case, and of course here in the U.S. as well. But we don't have good information yet on China or India, just to name two more territories. India, of course, is grappling with the coronavirus. They're really in the midst of it right now in terms of the first wave. I don't know if movie theaters are open or if they have shut down, when they might be. I think they're way too early to be even thinking about reopening if they are closed. Same thing with China. They've been given the green light, but everybody's just sort of waiting to say, well, when are we going to have new movies? And when are you going to make us know we really, really can open up? Because people don't want to act too swiftly. So those two major areas in the world are still, of course, under a yellow light. We're not sure what's going on there either. But we do have some updates, don't we? There is some stuff affecting the entertainment industry. We do have news from around the world.
Yeah, that's right. And I can tell you, you don't know when cinemas are going to open in China. Definitely not in India. You know what?
Are they shut down for sure? Do we know?
In India?
Yeah. I assume they are, but I don't know.
Some are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether all of them are. But I do know that on Broadway and in the West End, legit theater, is closed. It's, you know, all of those musicals and plays, they're closed. And we do know when they will be reopening, at least in the West End?
Well, they've said, look, the big shows like Les Mis and Hamilton say, look, we are not reopening in 2020. So it's not that they know when they're going to reopen, but they know it won't be this year. So they made that announcement. However, just like this morning, I believe, a new stage musical version of the animated film The Prince of Egypt was slated for this fall, and they have now announced they will be selling tickets for performances starting in November. I think they're going to sell them, and then they're going to have to rebook them next year, but maybe they know something we don't. But that seems highly optimistic. But we'll see where they end up. But that's what they're announcing now. So while the big shows are saying, yeah, it's not going to happen until 2021, the Prince of Egypt says, no, we will put on a show. And by God, if they're the only one open, maybe they think we can scrap up every person who's willing to go to the theater under onerous Korean-like circumstances where you sign in and get a temp check and get sprayed with disinfectant, you know, all the stuff that they do. Maybe that's their plan. I don't know. And we do know filming is beginning, don't we? That's starting to happen all over the world.
At least on television shows, yes.
That's right. The Bold and the Beautiful has officially resumed filming. Then they immediately shut down again and said, and they needed a day or two pause. And I believe they have started up again. Everyone must wear a mask at all times, except actors when filming. They've hired a full-time COVID-19 coordinator to make sure safety is a priority. That person probably helped them stop right away because some things weren't going right. And presumably there will be a lot less kissing. It is perhaps the first scripted series on U.S. soil to begin production again. So the CBS soap, The Bold and the Beautiful, making history, and we're all glad to see it.
And I think there were some productions in Iceland and in the Nordics that started already.
Right. Yeah. This is the first one in U.S. soil. And everybody's looking at what protocols do we need to put in place. And I've really been researching this next story very heavily. And it turns out one area they are looking to is the adult film industry. They had a huge turmoil after HIV, the AIDS epidemic, and dealing with HIV. Of course, unlike movies, the adult films, they're actually having sex. So they had to really grapple with this. And they came up with all sorts of protocols that have helped their industry stay in business. They've got this system where actors are, you know, tested every 14 days. They're on a checklist. You know, they're greenlit to keep working. It's a really interesting, sensible, science-based system. It's onerous to a degree. You got to get tested every 14 days, but there's no other way to do it. And that's everyone on the set, not just the actors. And they, of course, they have smaller sets, but it is a good system. It's been working very, very well for years now. And so the rest of Hollywood is saying, we can maybe learn a lesson from them. And you know what? This is the history of pornography in general. They have often broken through new technology, new standards, whether it's VHS, CD-ROM, DVD. The adult film industry has all digital cameras, live streaming. They are there first, making use of new technology, paving the way for the more mainstream version of the industry.
So you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Where porn goes, so goes the world.
That's absolutely true. And it's not here first, I'm sure.
That's true.
Well, you're at Cannes right now, but there was going to be a debut at Cannes, wasn't there? There was going to be a return to Cannes for a major industry player.
Yes, Spike Lee. He was not only going to be the president of the jury this year, but his film, The Five Bloods, was going to, I guess, premiere there out of competition. It was going to be a special selection.
Right, since he's on the jury, of course, it wouldn't be in competition. But why is that notable? Netflix. Netflix, of course. You know, Terry Fromo was saying, look, you can get a lot of attention, a lot of press, and get a lot of buzz out of coming to Cannes without having to be in competition. There's more to Cannes than just the 18 or so films that are fighting for the Palme d'Or. You know, Pixar has done it. Lots of big Hollywood movies have said, you know, we want to be at Cannes, we want the attention, but we don't want to be in competition. We don't want to be up against those other movies. That's not the game we're playing. So The Five Bloods was going to be at Cannes and Netflix was going to return. And Terry Fromo was hoping it would show Netflix and other streamers, look, there's still a lot to be gained by coming here. And that was going to be the first salvo in that it was going to happen. The movie's certainly getting a lot of attention on Netflix. It's on a lot of best of the year list so far. I haven't seen it. Our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, gives it a thumbs down, I believe, not to use the classic Siskel and Ebert thing. He's more sophisticated than that, but he was not a fan of the film. I haven't watched it yet. Have you?
No, probably this week.
Well, we know it will be eligible for the Oscars, and we have a better answer about when the Oscars will take place, don't we?
Yes, and I believe the correct answer is not February.
Later. The answer is later. No, later. They have a specific date, don't they?
Yes, they do. It's going to be in April.
That's right.
April I don't know, April 30th, maybe?
Something like that. And films released through February will be eligible for that year's Oscar. So it'll be a very tight schedule still. But that's interesting. And of course, after that announcement was made, I said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because you knew everyone else was going to adjust their schedules as well.
That's exactly what happened.
The Golden Globes, we don't need to cover it. Everybody is going to adjust their schedule, as has the Academy Museum. They have now rejiggered their opening release date. You know, the Academy Museum is going to open to the public 5 days after the Oscars on April 30th. That means the Oscars take place on April 25th. That's right. And the Academy Museum will open to the world. I'm sure they will have a 5-minute preview during the Academy Awards if that airs on television, or they'll have a video online or whatever to promote that. So that has been pushed back 4 months as well. I'm sure they could use the extra time to work on their, you know, displays and presentations.
Yeah, well, not to mention the fact that, you know, most museums are closed. So what's the point? You want to open up December 17th, which is what their plan was?
Well, everybody's got their, they bow to reality when they have to. And, you know, if you've got something open in December, you don't have to announce now. Look at all the Hollywood movies set for December. We've got Top Gun Maverick. What else was there? There was one
West Side Story.
That's on the same day. And one other movie on the same day or right around that time. Three big movies opening up on the same day. They're not going to open up in December. Or if they do, it won't be all of them. So they don't need to adjust their schedule until they're forced to. And that's when they will wait.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't think it's a big deal that the Academy Museum waited till now to say, oh, we'll open up in February. I mean, in April. It's just the natural order of things. You know, Prince of Egypt says, oh, we'll open up in December. By God. Well, you know what? Comes August or September, they'll say, never mind. That's just the way of the world.
You know, you said some very important words in that last sentence. Yes, Egypt, for instance. Mm-hmm. The word prince.
Oh, prince, you are a prince of the city.
Yes. Deal, I believe, was in there too. And also the word big, but only two of those words are important for our next segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, I mean, last week we talked to our friend Jeff Boucher and his new comic book podcast. He kind of mentioned his, I guess it's going to be on heavy metal, right?
That's right. That's a venerable magazine that covers comic books.
Right. A purveyor of European and cutting edge comics since the 1970s, by the way.
Yes.
Clearly someone was listening and now they're following Jeff's lead, because this week DC Comics announced a new podcast deal with Spotify. DC will be creating original podcasts based on pre-existing comic book storylines featuring iconic characters and top talent. That's all we know right now, except for the fact that this comes hard on the heels of Spotify signing Joe Rogan's blockbuster podcast to their platform and, of course, calling us. I mean, no, they didn't really call us, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a big push for Spotify. It obviously shows them being very serious about pumping up the podcast venue so that people spend more time on Spotify, but perhaps less time listening to music where they got to pay big fat royalties. But they're spending big fat money to log all this stuff. This is a pretty significant and interesting extension of the DC comic book universe. And boy, did they act fast. You know, Jeff was on our show, and within a few days, they like, we know what, we got to get on this tip. And they're doing their comic book podcast. So that's cool to see. It's very interesting. And you know what? If anybody there at DC is listening, if you want a Talking Dead type show around your podcast to let people know what episodes are coming up, about the characters, talking about the comic books and the big stars who may be involved with them with the same savvy and insight, you might consider Jeff Boucher.
Well, what if you held a concert and nobody came?
I know about that. I've done that constantly. I go to coffee houses and it clears out. I don't understand.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, my backyard constantly empty when I'm holding my concert.
Fire and rain, everybody. I'm going to sing Fire and Rain. Hello.
Well, the Korean boy band BTS did just that. They held a concert and the result was record-breaking revenue.
But nobody came.
Yeah, the massively popular group performed a concert, but fans couldn't come to the venue. They checked in via live stream for $35, less if you were a member of their fan club. The result? Get this. They grossed almost $20 million, or the equivalent of 15 sold-out shows at a 50,000-seat venue. You can argue this was a one-off result because of the pandemic.
I would.
Or when you look at the popularity of concerts in the virtual space of Fortnite and now this, you can argue it's the future, but no one can argue with the success. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a bit of a big whoop. They're one of the biggest bands in the world. We would expect them to draw a big audience for a stunt like this. They're not going to be able to do it every tour. People would rather see them live. I do think it's a bit of a one-off in terms of that. When you have free concerts at Fortnite, you can draw huge crowds as well. But it shows the power and popularity of the band, perhaps most importantly to their managers and the band members. They also signed up a lot of new people to their fan club. You know, you join their fan club, you got a discounted ticket, and that gets them in their system. You can send them emails. Maybe you get a monthly or annual fee from them of $5, $10 equivalent or whatever that might be. So I think that's also a big, powerful thing for them, getting people to join their fan club, get them on your newsletter. You can reach them directly. So it's a success all around, no doubt about it.
The video game called The Last of Us is set in a post-apocalyptic future. It received universal acclaim in 2013. It sold tons of copies and is regularly shortlisted among the best video games of all time. But no one was demanding a sequel. It wasn't really a franchise. It was more of a work of art.
Yes, yes.
Nonetheless, when you sell 17 million copies, a sequel is going to get made. People were wary, and the reaction has been a tad more divided, but The Last of Us 2, there's a very unique name, it is still generally getting hosannaed all over the place, and not just for the gaming, the improved artistry, and the queer female at its center. In this case, The Last of Us 2 is also being praised and setting new standards for what is known as accessibility. Differently abled people are as varied as abled people, with issues ranging from sight to hearing to needing one remote rather than two, or buttons rather than a joystick, and so on and so forth. The variations are endless once you start to pay attention and actually listen to the needs of gamers. Launch The Last of Us 2 and you'll find options on how to play that run to 5 dozen and counting, yes, more than 60 different ways you can choose settings to enhance your ability to play the game via customizations, from captions that use arrows to indicate who or from where a sound or snatch of dialogue is coming from, to the ability for those with challenged vision to highlight characters and villains in eye-catching outlines. It seems to be the most accessible video game in history, a title I'm sure it will surely be glad to relinquish soon. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. It's a great invisible thing. Most people will just plop in the game and start to play. They won't access the accessibility area. They won't care because they can play the game as they want. But for the people who matter, the people who want to be gamers but have these particular challenges in playing the game, this is just, you know, you saw videos of people online talking about how important and move people were. There was one guy who's a big gamer who's been pushing for accessibility, and he's literally in tears when he just called up the menu. He thought it was very sweet. He said, I just thought I would record it and, like opening up a new box on, he said, I just thought I'd show myself looking at the game and playing. It would be fun to talk about all the stuff. But he was genuinely moved and brought to tears by the 60 plus options that were displayed on there. It just, you know, it's like you can never do something and now suddenly you can, and it's something you care about a lot. It's great to see all these accommodations we take for granted, like ramps into every store, closed captioning on television, that make a big difference in people's lives. This is a game that didn't need to do this. It was a smaller company, but they spent a lot of time and effort on that. And I'm hoping they'll lose this title of the most accessible game because other people will follow suit and come up with even more variations. So good for them.
This next story, I find, it just baffles me.
Yeah.
Around the world, people are turning to books to challenge their thinking and to learn more about systemic racism and the importance of Black Lives Matter in that movement. Ta-Nehisi Coates, James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, they're all providing and proving wildly popular at the moment. That's happening all over the world, including the United Kingdom, where the nonfiction essay collection Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race, that's the title of the book, it is the most popular book in the country right now. That makes author Renee Edo Lodge the first Black British author to hit number one. The first. Not bestseller Zadie Smith or Bernardine Evaristo or Benjamin Zephaniah or numerous other high-profile talents who have hit the bestseller list in recent years. Edo Lodge is the first ever. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. Obviously, it's just incredibly too long in coming. That's for darn sure. It's kind of shocking. And I immediately thought,
I never would have said that. I would have, yeah.
You immediately go, not Zadie Smith, not that, you know, you start to name people and go, really? Wow. So yeah, it's a big deal. It's long overdue and good for her. It's a catchy name. Why I no longer talk to white people about race. Well, except you wrote a book about it. So that's a very, very cool of her. Congratulations for her to make that. And yes, it should have happened long, long ago, but it's just another barrier that's falling.
You know, she would probably say, as a writer, I was not technically talking in the most literal sense.
Exactly. Who's the other person? I'm trying to think if there are some isn't Paul Bailey British?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, I'm
isn't
like
he?
Paul Bailey never hit number one.
That just is shocking. He just won the Booker Prize.
Well, I don't know if he won the Booker, but he's I thought maybe he comes from an island and he's just part of the Commonwealth or something. But he's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I don't know if he ever won. I don't think so. It would probably be at the top of his list, but yeah, I immediately thought of Paul Bailey. Like, really? Not Paul? Good heavens. So great for her. Awesome to see.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, you might recall at the very top of the show, after we talked about like about 50 other things, when we were doing the intro to the show, we mentioned that we would be interviewing each other. And here's why. We're actually going to be talking about a story Michael Gilt wrote for Celluloid Junkie. And that is, it's up already. You can read it. And we're also going to be reading a listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com that comes from what I assume is an exhibitor. A movie theater operator, owner.
And they must work outside the U.S. based on what they've said. We've edited a little bit to highlight some of their most important points, but we really appreciate people writing into us. That's great. So here's the story. This is a letter from our listener that we've slightly edited. It says, the David Hancock interview was great. That was 2 weeks ago, right, Sperling?
Yes, episode 497.
And his title is?
He is, he's a cinema expert, but he's the head of the cinema division over at Omdia.
That's right.
So Omdia. Yeah.
So this person said the interview was great. Very good to hear. I agree with his opinions in general, and it's good to get this out to the cinema owners. However, one of the first issues I want to mention is that 30% estimated utilization of cinemas going forward. He's referring to the fact that cinemas will face a cap probably of 30 or 50% on people that can attend any one screening. David mentioned it's still possible to make money under these circumstances. I tend not to agree. People go to the cinema on Friday and Saturday nights as that's when they have time to do it. The cinemas may get some spillover to other nights, but it's really going to be limited. I don't see that being substantial and helping too much. Do you really expect any typical business like a restaurant can survive if its turnover dropped to 40% with the same or higher running costs? I find that hard to believe. Typical brick and mortar cinemas who have tickets and concessions only will find it extremely hard to survive under those conditions for a long period. Many cinemas are part of a bigger complex, and I see them being more viable in this restrictive period. I guess he's referring to cinemas that are in a mall rather than standalone. But getting to the bigger issue, what I am very worried about is the U.S. and how it is dealing with the virus. For example, California is starting to open up, and they're having a big wave of infections already. If they do open up further, it could be quite bad. And much of the U.S. probably should be closed again, but will not, as I cannot see Trump pulling back on the economy now after he has wasted all this time not taking the virus seriously. The economy needs to restart, but at the same time, it could lead to unknown extremes concerning an explosion in virus infections. And if California is disrupted, this will disrupt the food chain that is the source of the Hollywood blockbuster films cinemas rely on. That's a worry to cinema owners looking back into the U.S. and seeing what's happening here. We understand that the U.S. is a key market that must open. If it does not open, I see studios pushing films until it can. And that's bad news for exhibitors as it occurs. Are they freaking out? Not yet, is my answer. As we are still in the government support period, everyone is unsure how anything will turn out. When the government support finishes and the exhibitors will then have to sink or swim, that's when the freakout will happen. I myself feel freaked out about that period. End quote.
Well, and so what I would say, as you know, somebody here in the United States, what government support?
Well, there's been a lot of government support in the U.S. People have unemployment. No, yeah. I know, but that's stopping. The Democrats are trying to get more bills pushed through to keep propping up businesses so that employees can still get paid. What you want is to support businesses economically, because if you just let them close shop forever, you can't turn the lights back on in 3, 6 months, 9 months, or whenever, when you can get life back to somewhat normal. If they close, they're gone forever. And those people will struggle much harder to get a new work. So it's better to do like other countries have done and pay 70% of employee salaries until you're giving the green light to opening up again. And that's
to give you some sense, yeah. In Europe, all of the cinema chains are, or at least all the countries have said, when they are reopening today, as a matter of fact, is the reopening day in France. So cinemas are opening in France today, with restrictions, of course, which we'll get to in a moment. And I think Scotland is the furthest out. I think it's in August sometime.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the problem is they may have to shut down again. But and they still need support even after they reopen, because they're going to be at much less capacity. So if they can't even break even, they need government support, even if they're reopening. You know, you don't say, oh, well, the lights are on, you're fine again. Well, no, they're not. They're going to be opening.
It's also not just government support. It's also support from landlords. Landlords
aren't going to just say, never mind, I don't want any money this year. They're not going to do that any more than the employees are going to say, well, I'll keep working. You know, you don't have to pay me. So yeah, it has to come from the government. Landlords aren't, they never mind about June. They're not going to do it. It's not going to happen unless the government pays them directly a certain percentage.
Yes. Now, one of the things that was talked about, was the turnover dropping 40% with the same costs. And almost every single exhibitor I've talked to is doing modified menus, and that's modified concession menus.
They're not going to offer everything. Yeah.
And by the way, restaurants are doing the same thing. When you go to a restaurant, you kind of look at
It's normal. The Cheesecake Factory. The main basic things you expect, but they're not doing every little thing. You go get a shake. Some places aren't offering whipped cream for various reasons. Yeah, they have limited menu, but that's okay. Most people are going to buy popcorn and soda, so they would be fine with a limited menu, I think. But people aren't going to buy as much.
Well, and since this came in, this email came in, for instance, Australia started to heat up. The infection rate is heating up, and they've started to drop back to, I guess they were in stage three in certain parts of the country. They're now dropping back to stage two, or not moving ahead to stage three.
Right. The point is that these situations are going to go up and down. If the U.S. has to shut down, this person is saying, if they can't keep the cinemas open, no one's going to put out any movies anywhere in the world. And they're right. If you don't have U.S. and China, they're not going to release big blockbuster films. They'll release smaller films.
To give you some sense, Disney right now is the first film out that with Mulan, July 24th. Unhinged on July 4th. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. The first Hollywood giant studio blockbuster is Mulan, July 24th. However, I've heard from a couple of exhibitors in various parts of the world that Disney itself is not booking content. So they're not actually booking theaters right now. So it'll be very interesting to see, and by the way, I hear that's not just true of Mulan, but also of all of their repertory content.
Well, what does
that
mean? Do they need to? There's not any other movie that's going to be competing with them. Everybody's ready to open their doors wide open for them. Is there some telling thing like they have a financial obligation if they take a certain step or something?
No. I think it's just a matter of they don't want to book and then find out, you know what? Actually, we're not going to open that movie. Or you know what? All the theaters in a certain territory have closed. We're not going to open the film. So they just kind of do a wait and see thing. And you're right. Normally they would book, they would do allocation where they say, okay, here AMC, you'll get these sites, and Regal, you'll get these sites. That happens less and less now, but still they do allocation, 4 to 6 weeks out.
Right
around now.
Right. But they don't need to, because there's no competition. They don't need to lock anybody in. All right. So we know that theaters are reopening in the U.S. mid-June and July. We know that two of the big chains, Regal and Cinemark, said, hey, we will follow all local and state guidelines. And then AMC said, we're going to reopen up and we'll follow all local and state guidelines. But then
they didn't say that. They said
we will follow the local and state guidelines. We'll encourage you to wear a mask, but we're not going to require it unless it's required by the local and state. But then they slipped up by saying, well, and we don't want to get into that political controversy. And because they said that, people suddenly woke up and said, wait a second, why aren't you requiring masks? Why are you not following the science instead of just weren't, you know, why do you care what a county in Oklahoma says? Why don't you just follow the science and say all customers must wear a mask? And there was a big blowback. The other two had avoided it, but AMC slipped up by opening the door and admitting their decision was politically based rather than science based. Now, AMC does have a science advisor, but apparently that person was telling them what they wanted to hear. Because if they had a science advisor, that person was telling them, okay, this is what you want to do. Here's the best way we can do it. Rather than saying, here is the best guidance from the pandemic and epidemiology experts in the country. We want our science advisor to help us follow that. They were having their science advisor, if they don't require it, just follow what they say. Yeah. So they need to learn that they need the science advisor to help them do what is best recommended, not tell them what they want to hear. Do you think this sort of flip up, you know, they all suddenly said, okay, we'll require masks. It's not a big deal, right? No one's going to remember this a week or two from now. They're just going to know when they go to the movies, they got to wear a mask.
Yeah, no, just like they messed up and said that, this is AMC, that is. Many years ago, they said, we're going to allow tweeting and texting in our, you know, people kind of forget that they were the ones that said that and then had to walk it back.
Right. So we've got a story. Now, tell me, you asked me to write this story. You guys are the experts in exhibition. And I was like, why are you asking me to write a story on exhibition? I was very excited that you would reach out to me. But what made you think, we should do this story? You wanted to talk about the future challenges that cinemas are going to face. We know all the sanitation and we wear masks and all this stuff that you got to do, 30% capacity, every other row is empty, all these things that people are going to do to try and keep their customers safe. But you also said, you know what, there's going to be a lot of problems after they reopen. This is not the end of the story. This is just the beginning of it.
Yes, correct. And the reason we're trying to expand our network of contributors. We know we needed to cover the reopening of cinemas in the U.S. We aren't going to break news and, be the Hollywood Reporter Variety.
You got to look next and think, give them something new.
So we wanted a little bit more, of a thoughtful analytical piece, which is what you've provided, by the way.
Really?
yes. So, and you kind of went through like some of the items that, are going to be a bit of an issue, such as too many movies coming out all at once, or, basically 30 movies coming out all between September and, the end of the year, all big movies, all trying to find space, which they probably can. There'll probably be a little shuffling here and there.
Well, I don't think so. There is a traffic jam of big films. You have Mulan, and then the following week you have Tenet. And then a week or two later, there's going to be another big movie. But once you have Mulan and Tenet, we recognize, okay, maybe if every theater is open, they're at 30 or 50% capacity, half the screens are for Mulan, half the screens are for Tenet. They can play for months and draw crowds and end up making their money, but there's no room for another movie the following week because these movies will not have played out and had the big, massive opening weekend where, 80% of the screens are sold out all the time. It's going to just be those movies. So how are they going to deal with this logjam?
I don't know how they're going to do it. I think that basically they have weekends where five movies come out in a weekend and they manage to make it work. They don't play every film in every location. That's one way they make it work. They say, okay, you know what? You'll get the theater in Uptown for Mulan.
But that's when you have every screening at every cinema available. In this new reality, I don't think it's possible. You're not going to be able to have this release schedule pan out because movies need to play for months. The reality is, in the old system, movies would make most of their money in the first 10 or 20 days, by far. You make 80, 90% of your box office gross in the first, couple weeks, and then you were done. And you could play for months, and you could make good, real money. But for most big movies, you'd make $100 million opening weekend. This is just a given nowadays. So I don't see how it's going to work. And there's no one who can adjudicate because, Disney wants their movie and Fox wants their movie. Oh, that's the same thing. And Universal wants their movie, right?
So they have certain tracks as well.
That's going to be a big problem. And you pointed out the problem of teenagers. They don't clean up their rooms, and you've got these great new sanitation standards, but how are you going to enforce them 2 weeks after it in place? And you're like, really? I got to do it again? Is that a serious problem?
Yeah. I mean, it's a serious problem. Forget sanitation. It's, hey, clean up, lock up, do all of these things, certain things, lock the door. Yeah, sure. That happens every night. But, just trying to follow procedures and operational procedures, trying to get people that will do it again and again and again. And then, of course, having all of these new procedures that they have to be trained on, it's costly, number one. And, it has to be enforced. For instance, masks. Who's going to enforce that?
Oh, you mean the customers now? The employees will be wearing masks and gloves pretty much everywhere. But in terms of enforcement of customers, they're saying, look, you got to wear a mask except when you're actively eating or drinking. But we know employees don't go through the theater and, you know, call out people who are texting or look scrolling on their phone, because it happens all the time now. Unless somebody is really talking a lot and someone complains, they don't bother because they can't. They just can't police that anymore. But mask enforcement, you know, someone texting is annoying to me. Somebody keeping their mask off for the entire 2.5 hours while I'm trapped in a room with them and the air is recirculating, now they're risking my health. Now I'm getting angry. So that is going to be a big problem. And certainly the staff, they're not bouncers. They're not prepared to deal with people. We had a guy on a plane who wouldn't get off and refused to wear a mask.
Wouldn't put a mask on and then refused to get off.
Right, and refused to get off. It was a big kerfuffle and it took a while to get him off the plane. It was, you know, theater owners, they can't deal with this. This is just, there's no good solution to that. None whatsoever.
One of the things that has been discussed is that the way people go to cinemas now is they just show up most of the time.
Right.
And now, or they'll plan it, you know,
a minute in advance. Yeah.
But now there is some thinking that people not wanting to be in large groups will actually plan ahead and maybe even pick what would have been considered inopportune times, like Tuesday at 3 p.m, to go to the movies.
Now, I would absolutely do that. But if you only have 10 or 15 people in a theater, are they going to keep those daytime screenings during the week? Because they won't be that popular. The cost of sanity. Yeah. So the argument from View, from Richards, is that his name?
Yes. Tim Richards is the CEO of View.
Yeah. He argued, look, there is going to be a lot more spillover. People are going to go weeknights. They're going to go during the day because they have more flexibility right now. And we believe those less peak hours are going to become a lot more popular because people want to self-select and stay away from the relatively crowded 30% capacity, whatever that's going on the weekends. That's possible. I just don't think it's going to be that much.
Yeah, I think that also he mentioned that the box office, the opening weekend box office won't be as important because the gross will actually be over a longer period of time due to the restrictions.
Uh-huh.
You also mentioned that concession sales will crater. I don't know necessarily whether that's true.
Oh, but absolutely. I'm not going to be buying popcorn. Yeah, I like going to a big movie. You're going to be wearing a mask. You got to take it off. It just feels less clean. I'm sure the theater concessions will be healthy and safe and clean and delicious, but you're just not going to be in the mood to deal with, you know, you got a mask on and then deal with the popcorn and the soda. I think it's just going to be less of a party fun atmosphere. It's just going to be one less thing to touch and to have to put in the cup holder on the seat. It's just one less thing to deal with. You know, I hesitate to bring in a bag or a phone to a place. You know, because I don't want to put it down somewhere. I don't want to deal with it. So I think concessions, it's not going to be as casual and fun an atmosphere. There's just no way. So plus there'll be fewer options, like you say. There's going to be smaller crowds. So even if they're fairly full, it's not going to be the same big crowd you have on Friday and Saturday nights, even under the best of circumstances. So I don't think there's any way you can imagine concession sales will be anywhere near normal. If you're lucky, they'll be 30% of normal, right?
Well, and who knows?
Right. I mean, right now, let's say they're 30% of normal. That's where they make most of their money, right? Ticket sales.
But you know, right now they're getting nothing. So,
well, I know, but we're talking about them being able to stay open week to week. They have certain locked costs, sunk costs, and they've got staff and they've got to make food. If they are getting 30% of ticket sales and 30% of concession sales, and we're going to have to assume that they're not going to be doing it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we're going to have to imagine it's significantly lower than what they would normally make 1 year earlier. Even say it's 30%, say it's 50%. That's still half what they would make 1 year earlier. That's going to be very hard for them to look at, you know, profitability.
And of course, they will always be looking ahead to what is happening. Everybody knows that pandemics come in waves.
Yeah.
There were several waves to the Spanish flu. People don't realize that there never was a vaccine for that. Okay. There never was and still isn't. And so the question is, when will that next wave occur of this particular, I don't want to say flu, it's the coronavirus. When will that happen and how will it be treated? You see it happening right now in China where they're closing just a specific zone of Beijing. They're not closing the entire city. What will that mean for exhibitors, for cinema operators? That it remains to be seen.
So are the exhibitors, you talk to them all the time, you have the finger on the pulse of the exhibition industry. Are people excited? Like, yes, finally we get to back to work. Are they just nervous or are they you know,
no, they're excited. They're looking, I mean, they also realize, wow, this is a completely, it's a whole new world.
Yeah. So they're a little door-stayish. They're feeling pretty optimistic. Well, good for them.
Well, not that they're optimistic. I mean, there are some that are saying, I'm not opening. I'm not going to open until I have a brand new movie to show.
Well, of course, they're all waiting for Mulan. I mean, I understand that everybody's waiting for new content, but they're looking at late July and going, great, we're going to get to reopen again. So the correct. People saying yes. that are like, yes, and they are excited. They're not thinking, oh my God, how is this going to work? Are we going to make enough money to keep the lights on? They're like, yes, finally, back to the movies.
They're reluctantly excited. How about that?
Okay, I'll take that. Well, we can't wait for the coronavirus to die, but unfortunately, some other people have died this week before the coronavirus. Joel Schumacher, the director we mentioned early on in the show, we just found that out at the last minute. Some sad news from Korea. K-pop singer Yohan has died at 28. He was a rising talent and a member of two big groups. First, he was a member of NOM, or No Other Men, and now he's a member of TST, which is short for Top Secret. The cause of death is unknown, so unfortunately, we have to worry that it may be yet another person who's dealing with mental health and depression and the crushing spotlight of the music industry in some parts of the world, including here in the U.S. But that was a real shame. On the other hand, at the other possible end of the spectrum, a person dying too young at 28, we have British singer Vera Lynn dying at 103. God bless her.
Excuse me, Dame.
Dame Vera Lynn, thank you very much. Yeah. Known as the Force's sweetheart, she was kind of the voice of World War II for the UK in a way. And she's a classic example of someone where you go, oh my God, was she still alive? Yes, she was.
Yes, and, yes she was.
And she sang the classic We'll Meet Again and The White Cliffs of Dover, among many others. In fact, on May 8th, the UK celebration of VE Day, taking place amidst the pandemic, included the country being encouraged to come out on their balconies or streets or whatever and sing along to We'll Meet Again. And in fact, the Queen quoted it when speaking to the nation during the coronavirus pandemic. She said, we will meet again. And everybody knew that was a reference to Vera Lynn. So 103, good for her.
When is the Queen going to quote us?
That's what I'd like to know. She said, this kerfuffle with Meghan and Harry is a big whoop. They'll be fine.
And then I showed up and said, well, since you said big whoop, let me push her over. And
that brings us to video. That's if only we did video.
Oh, brother. Well, also stage and screen actor Ian Holm died at the age of 88. Now, if that name sounds familiar, I guarantee you, if you recognize the name, you would definitely recognize the face.
Absolutely. He's had a quietly impressive career spanning decades. Playwright Harold Pinter said Ian Holm was his favorite actor. In fact, he won huge accolades, including a Tony, for his performance in the debut of Pinter's classic The Homecoming. And he did everything from the RSC to TV to film, a lot of classic roles, though perhaps definitely, not perhaps, but definitely without the aura of celebrity that accrued to others like Derek Jacobi or Ian McKellen, partially because he never had a huge, I think, TV series, or even when he was in a big, big movie like The Lord of the Rings, it was with a smaller role. He wasn't the Gandalf character like Ian McKellen. He played Bilbo Baggins, that's right, in the film The Lord of the Rings, which was a smaller part. So that was very cool. But he had an Oscar-nominated and BAFTA-winning role in Chariots of Fire. And that's where he played a trainer. And everybody who's seen that movie remembers the scene where he's listening to hear what happens during the race and has just this lovely, sweet little moment when his runner wins. It's just really adorable. He had a great role in Ridley Scott's Alien and a lot of good movies. Big Night, The Madness of King George, Time Bandits, Brazil, Dance with a Stranger, The Sweet Hereafter. He even did a voice in Pixar's Ratatouille, and he was in the Emmy-winning miniseries Holocaust. That was a great, great miniseries. And he played Napoleon like three times because he was not tall of stature, even though he was big in talent.
Well, yeah, I think what's interesting is that you said he had a small role in The Lord of the Rings as Bilbo. Of course, because he's a hobbit.
That's right. And, you know, this is cool. He played Bilbo and Frodo Baggins in The Lord of the Rings. So that seems unusual. And like Alec Guinness in Star Wars, he would probably be kind of astonished that Bilbo is the first thing mentioned when he died, but everybody did. But he played Bilbo in the film and he played Frodo in a BBC adaptation in 1981. There are 26 half-hour episodes. They are tremendously good. I thought that was going to be the best adaptation of The Lord of the Rings in my lifetime. It's a great radio play. In fact, Bill Nighy does the voice of Sam Gamgee, which I didn't realize that, but I have it on CD. I love that series. You can search it out at your library or buy a copy of it on CD or digital audio. It's a great, great thing. It's 13 hours long, and it is absolutely terrific. It is a great radio adaptation, fully you know, fully cast and performed and dramatized. It's great. And Peter Jackson posted a lovely tribute to him on Facebook. Apparently, Ian Holm had Parkinson's and said he couldn't reprise his performance as Bilbo for the Hobbit movies. When Peter came to him about it, he had retired quietly, but nobody knew about it. And Peter talked about his parents having Parkinson's, and they talked with Ian and his wife. And instead of saying he can't do it, they ended up discussing how they could make it happen. And so they decided to bring the set of Bag End to London. And in fact, Elijah Wood, who played Frodo, he showed up just for moral support, just to be there for Ian as he recreated the role of Bilbo. And Ian gave his last performance ever on that set after having essentially retired for health reasons. And so he was on the, I didn't know that, but that film, The Hobbit, features his last performance and with, you know, Elijah Wood off screen cheering him on. And Jackson quotes his last line from Return of the King, "I think I'm quite ready for another adventure," which is just touching, very sweet. In fact, they had an image from the ships going off to the west, which is at the end of Lord of the Rings. And even that scene, that sort of made me tear up as I read about it. So, but I'm an old softy.
Well, you know what? It's time for us to have another adventure, and we appreciate you joining us on this one. Of course, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, subscribe to us, rate and review us. It does help us out when you do. That information, along with links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And you can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it is theroadgoeseveronandon.com. A little Lord of the Rings reference for you.
I was going to say, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that particular website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.